It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As Hollywood's award season is upon us, we check in on the Oscar buzz and hear your predictions and explore films you think deserve to take home that golden statuette at the 96th Academy Awards. Be part of this Oscars discussion. Call in with a question. Share perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anna Thompson-Hotchick is here, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater. Anna, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you. Happy to be back and talk about some great movies from 2023, for sure.
Yes, so let's take stock here. There were actor strikes, there were work stoppages, there was the midsummer box office Barbenheimer phenomenon. How would you depict the year in film? What words would you use?
Yeah, so despite all of the sort of setbacks with the strike and unrest, it was really a really strong year. One of the stronger years, I think, in recent memory. And I think, studio executives, I think, may be at last realizing that everyone's kind of tired of superhero movies and and that, there is actual audience demand for, good, creative movies. And when those stories, right, have the backing of, really strong directors and good writers and excellent acting, people are going to show up. The audience is going to show up. And I think that's ultimately the lesson of Barbenheimer, is that, people want to see good movies.
Oh, and you mean they have like an appetite for quantum physics?
Right, exactly. And you think about, there are elements to Oppenheimer that are very, confusing, right? It is a kind of a talky movie in lots of respects. But, ultimately it has some excellent acting, it has some beautiful cinematography, and it tells really, one of the, most incredible stories of the 20th century. And so, people responded to that. And now, of course, the various, award seasons are responding to it as well, right? So, So I think that's the lesson. And ultimately that Hollywood, I don't know if it's necessarily, back in full force, but it's certainly, I think that Hollywood has really rebounded from kind of the nadir of a few years of 2021, when, theaters were just really trying to figure out how to move forward from the pandemic. So, yeah.
Going deeper there on Oppenheimer and maybe some lessons learned, as we look at threats and geopolitical threats, I'm just wondering, has it furthered a conversation about the role of nuclear weapons and what we should learn, from generations ago in the Manhattan Project?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, I think the other element right now that I think it certainly added to Oppenheimer's sort of success is the instability in our geopolitics right now. Right. Mm. And so, so that I think perhaps is a factor, people wanting to learn their history, their nation's history, and then kind of all of the complexities of that. And I think, that is one thing that Christopher Nolan, the director of Oppenheimer, he again, one of the reasons the film is so talky is because he actually is using real congressional testimony, in part of the script. And so, that history, right, is so, crucial, but, Nolan doesn't really skimp corners either, right? He's giving us, kind of elements, elements there of reality, right, with how this story unfolded.
In 3 hours.
Right. And it is dense, it is long. But there's enough there too, of course, with dramatizing the Trinity test, which is just such an incredible sequence in the film, that also provides the action, right, that people are seeking too, right, to kind of, because if it was just congressional testimony for 3 hours, that
no,
would be, right? So yeah, but you know, it's not just Oppenheimer, right? Martin Scorsese has proven that, you know, again, people are going to go to 3.5 hours with Killers of the Flower Moon. And so, you know, this is a good year ultimately for historians in a way, because we have two films that are based on nonfiction, you know, dense nonfiction books, right? That are sort of, you know, retelling a sto these stories that have kind of gotten lost to history, and finding ways, audience are finding these stories, and audiences want to know more about our nation's history, which I think is great. So, yeah.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick with us, film studies senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, as we talk about Academy Awards season and what you think should be of the nominations that you've seen. 800-642-1234 to join in. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Anna, Christopher Nolan already won a Best Director Award for Oppenheimer at the Golden Globes. In his career, has not yet won the title at the Oscars. Is this the year that Christopher Nolan wins?
Yes, I think that's a pretty safe bet that Christopher Nolan is going to take home the Academy Award. And, you know, really ultimately for his a body of work that has really always demanded a lot of attention from both audiences and critics. He came on the scene early in 2000, I think it was, with Memento, which was a movie that made a lot of waves. I think it debuted at Sundance, actually. And it from the very start, when Memento hit, you know, kind of hit theaters, and critics really responded to it. Now, Christopher Nolan does have some things about his career. He's not always been the best director for women. That being said, I think that you have two very strong performances in Oppenheimer, despite the fact, of course, that Oppenheimer is really obviously a man's story. Ultimately, there's the performance of Florence Pugh as Jean Tatlock and Emily Blunt as Kitty Oppenheimer. Those two actresses, you know, they did quite a bit with those roles. They're smaller roles, but they have definitely some showiness to them. And I think those are two characters that Oppenheimer, that I'm sorry, Nolan, you know, he did a good job with ultimately, given the constraints of the roles ultimately. And so I think that is that shows his evolution to some extent as a filmmaker as well, right? But I think just the sweep of Oppenheimer too is really going to the cinema, you know, the epic sweep of that of the story is really going to help him just bring home that statuette ultimately
Okay,
too.
so you did say open the door to Best Director for women. Is it a snub or not a snub with director Greta
Yeah.
Gerwig and
So, you know,
Barbie?
it's right. So that again, that of course, a few weeks ago, that was all the rage, the debate, right? And I saw Barbie in the theaters. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was surprised that Greta Gerwig was not nominated. I think that, you know, I mean, and I've read a number of analysis about this. The body of folks that vote on just the director nominations is a pretty serious group. And I think that, you know, Barbie, you know, again, I love the film, but there are those that would probably see it as a little bit of a lightweight, right? Narratively, it certainly doesn't have like the seriousness, you know, of a movie like Oppenheimer, right? And then using, you know, it is a really creative script, but ultimately it is a script based on a toy, right? And so that when it's just directors that are voting on nominations, that really kind of skews the nominating sort of nominated films in favor of weightier, heftier stories. And so one critic that I had read was that, you know, it's not that the Academy has snubbed all women, right? Because you have the director Justine Triet of you know, she is nominated for Anatomy of a Fall, which is ultimately a more serious, a more complex film than Barbie in some respects. And so And Greta Gerwig is nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. I do think she has an edge there to perhaps bring that home.
Okay.
You know, she certainly plenty of folks have taken notice because you know she, that Barbie was the highest grossing film ever directed by a woman. So, you know, I wouldn't, you know, cry for Greta Gerwig at any point. I think her career is chugging along just fine, and
Okay. All
she'll
right.
find lots of other projects, I'm sure, that to helm. And I would even say that, you know, a few years ago, Little Women, I think her version of Little Women, I think ultimately, you know, when we think about notions of, you know, what makes for a serious Oscar film, Little Women is probably superior to Barbie in that on that point, because it, you
Interesting.
know, it has that period appeal and the complexity of narrative.
Anna Thompson-Hajek, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies in English at UW-Whitewater, as we absorb the Oscar buzz, be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Academy Award nominations are unveiled, we check in with you on worthy Oscar contenders alongside analysis from UW-Whitewater Film Studies lecturer Anna Thompson-Hajek. Be part of the conversation about memorable films. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Glenn in Stoughton. Glenn, hi.
Hello.
What film would you like to bring up?
Weirdly, I want to bring up, to me, the most surprising film of the year by far, Godzilla Minus One. If you would have told me, I would be moved to tears multiple times in a Godzilla movie, I would have said, you're nuts. It's not the Godzilla I grew up with as a kid. Fantastic movie that I've thought about many times since seeing it. And I had some reservations about some of the big films of the year. I definitely liked them, but Godzilla Minus One just knocked it out of the park.
Glenn, thank you. Anna, what do you think of that analysis?
Yeah, so I haven't seen that particular film. I had heard that that it, you know, received very good reviews, and just kind of a different take on kind of the Godzilla narrative. And so I thank the caller for bringing that film up. And it, you know, I haven't seen it, but you know, it's interesting to think about, you know, the history of Godzilla. You know, the original Godzilla was released about a decade after the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and so it is a it always has kind of functioned as an allegory for nuclear war ultimately. And so, you know, and from that Japanese perspective, and so you know, I think that's interesting, and I definitely it makes me want to see the film for sure. So yeah.
Glenn, what comes up for you as you think back to what you saw, and why did it move you so much?
Well, for one thing, it unlike the kind of goofier Godzilla movies that I grew up with, it really focuses on the characters. The monster is in the background to some degree. It's really about this family that comes together, and what they experience, and like I said, it's unbelievably emotional. I took a bunch of friends who were not Godzilla fans. You know, they're just like, oh, whatever, that'll be fun, and they all loved this movie. I thought everybody'd be, you know, asking me, why did you take me to this? But it just it, and it's super emotional. Also, there's echoes of classic films like Jaws in this
movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
When they pull in the music from the original Godzilla movie in 1954. I mean, I had chills.
Well, it's interesting, too, Glenn brings up music, because let's talk a little bit about scores, Anna. And, you know, what you make of the score with Robbie Robertson has a posthumous nomination for Killers of the Flower Moon. And we had heard just there in our intro there, the Osage Oil Boom from the soundtrack. What do you make of these scores?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting to me because both the Killers of the Flower Moon and the Oppenheimer scores, they are not these kind of overbearing, you know, sort of sweeping scores that so often are, you know, get ascribed to the epic film. They're a little quieter. And, you know, I found both scores for both of those films to be, you know, just very effective in how they, you know, set the mood. I think, I had told your producer that Robbie Robertson, I think, may have the edge just because it is that posthumous nomination. He was never awarded an Academy Award before. And he has that long association with Martin Scorsese. Mm-hmm. And then Ludwig Göransson for Oppenheimer, both, you know, that score too, really is, you know, it manages to be enough, but never too much in kind of in helping us to kind of understand the action and providing that mood. Now, the other interesting kind of nomination in the mix there is John Williams for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. And he would be the oldest recipient of an Academy Award at 92 years old if he wins. But I don't think he will. He's already got 5. So, you know, it is a nice, you know, inclusion there in the lineup of musicians. But yeah, he's got plenty. So.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick with us, film studies senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, as we discuss the upcoming Academy Awards and the nominations. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Okay, so Best Actress, you say Lily Gladstone is likely to win Best Lead Actress for her role as Molly Burkhart in Killers of the Flower Moon. And let's hear a scene where Molly is laughing off Ernest Burkhart's early attempts to win her affection while driving her around town.
He told me he was going with Matt Williams for a time.
You talk too much.
Oh, I don't talk too much. Just thinking who I got to beat in this horse race, that's all.
I didn't realize this was a race. I don't care for watching horses.
Well, I'm a different kind of horse.
Hong Fashi. Shomikasi Sheko Shiajimi.
What was that?
Shomikasi. That's how you are.
What makes Gladstone a top contender for the award?
So, from a, again, a cultural standpoint, of course, she is the first Native woman to be nominated for this award. And so, you know, just again, there's that element of, you know, the culture, right? But, you know, her performance is a very effective performance. It's understated, and yet she is kind of the moral core of this film, right? When the film opens, it's her that we hear. And so she does not have as much screen time as some of the other actresses nominated in this category. And so I do think that there is a chance, right, that, you know, Emma Stone could come in there, just because Emma Stone, her performance in Poor Things is so masterful, and it's just an incredibly physical performance. But Emma Stone has an Oscar, right, already. And so...
you always look at what's in the bank already. So,
right.
But
right.
this is my time to shout out to Annette Bening as in that category for her, you know, in the biopic Naiad. And, you know, I think she has I think she has a chance as well in playing that long-distance swimmer, Diana Nyad. UW-Whitewater Film Studies scholar Anna Thompson-Hodgick giving us analysis on the Academy Awards nominations. And let's hear from you. Call in with a question. Share comments along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. That is Billie Eilish's What Was I Made For? It's one of two Barbie movie tracks up for Best Original Song. And we take stock of the nominees for the Oscars and hear about your picks. 265 films vying for Best Picture. The Academy revealed 10 films in contention for its top honor. Call in with a question. Share your reactions. 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick teaches film studies and English at UW-Whitewater. So Margot Robbie didn't receive a Best Lead Actress nomination for her role as Barbie. What do you make of Margot Robbie's name being off that list of nominees?
Well, I mean, again, it was surprising to me. I mean, I thought she did a very capable job there, but she did. You know, she is nominated as a producer credit for Best Picture, so she'll still get to go, right? She's gonna be there, but you know, there again, kind of critics have said, you know, she was nominated, right, for her portrayal of Tanya Harding in I, Tanya, and that arguably was a more complexly rendered role, right, than Barbie. And so, you know, again, I did find it surprising. I really enjoyed that film. I enjoyed her performance. But again, with her off that list, it does sort of make room for other individuals like Sandra Hüller, right, for her performance in Anatomy of a Fall. And Sandra Hüller gave two really strong performances this year, both in Anatomy of a Fall and in Zone of Interest. And so when we have a more sort of international contingent of voters in the Academy membership, right, we see a wider spectrum of folks that are nominated ultimately. And so, I mean, I think it would be interesting to know kind of where Margot Robbie fell in the voting, and if Hüller was the kind of the factor there that kind of, you know, pushed her out. And then of course you mentioned you're a fan of Nyad. Annette Bening, you know, this is her fifth nomination and she still has not won an Academy Award.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that I think that, you know, it would be great, honestly, if Annette Bening did finally bring it home. I don't think she will, but you know, she's 65 years old. She's been around in Hollywood now for quite a while, turning up, you know, really consistently strong performances, you know, all the way back to the Grifters in the early 1990s. And so, you know, her embodiment of Diana Nyad, I think, is so fully developed. And I think too, she and Jodie Foster together are so fun to watch.
They are. My goodness. I mean, yeah. How often are Oscars about someone's career rather than a single film?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, sometimes they are. I mean, a lot of times they are, actually, you know, kind of looking, and I think when Leonardo DiCaprio won for The Revenant, I mean, that was a really amazing performance, but it was just as much about kind of the body of work when he won. And so it is a little surprising to with Annette Bening in her case that there hasn't been more sort of buzz that she could finally bring it home, just because, you know, she's been overlooked now so many times. Angela Bassett's another example where finally, you know, the Academy gave her an honorary Academy Award last year, and because she kept getting overlooked again and again and again. And I think Angela Bassett is younger than Annette Bening, so I mean that's interesting too, right? That Angela Bassett got their honorary statuette last year.
You're running the numbers, I think. There,
yeah.
You talked about the international influence in these categories, and the Academy calling itself a global organization representing the best of an international art form. How international is the Academy compared to previous years?
So I guess I can't tell you exactly the percentage there, but in 2016 is when they really kind of, you know, rejiggered their membership. And that was in the wake of the Oscars So White campaign, you know, that really pushed back against the lack of diversity in nominations. And so, you know, there was kind of this reckoning in the membership that, okay, we do really need to, you know, broaden our ranks. And so that as a result of that, yeah, we just see, you know, we see movies like Past Lives, for example, from Korea in this, in, you know, in our Best Picture lineup. We see Anatomy of a Fall from Germany. We see Zone of Interest that kind of has both German and British kind of origins. And so it really, you know, to see those movies too in that Best Picture lineup, you know, that has a real factor in how many people are going to seek them out to watch them. And then it has an effect on distribution. So the fact that, you know, I watched with my family Anatomy of a Fall last weekend, and you know, we could just stream it, right? We don't we don't have to live in New York or Los Angeles to see these movies. We can stream them, you know, off Amazon or off Netflix, and it provides those movies then with a visibility that they just didn't have a decade ago or two decades ago.
I can feel exactly what you said there. I mean, we just last weekend sat down with the family and watched Naiad with my swimmer daughter and told her not to complain anymore about those long distance 500s. But again, you know, it was much more accessible to us to be able to see an Oscar contender. You know, with that said, the Oscars used to be a really big TV event, and viewership has been up for the past 2 years, though still historically low. How do you think that this year's event will compare to, you know, recent years?
So my prediction is that the ratings will be certainly up from last year. And I think part of it, you know, every time we have movies that do well at the box office that are nominated in these prime categories, then the viewership, the ratings do increase. And so historically, you know, the number one Oscar telecast for ratings was 1998, when Titanic, you know, was kind of brought home all those awards. And we've never again experienced ratings that high. But the fact that both Oppenheimer and Barbie are nominated, I think will certainly help with the ratings. I also think you have some really, you know, thinking about kind of the way the telecast goes, some songs that are nominated, obviously all the songs get featured, right? And so I think a lot of people are going to be tuning in to watch Ryan Gosling's performance of I'm Just Ken, because I imagine it's going to be quite the showstopper, right?
Give your two cents there, in, you know, having Ryan Gosling there, and it, you know, in not having Margot Robbie, what do you think of Ken getting that nomination?
Yeah. I mean, the optics of it certainly aren't great. Right. And so when, you know, in the day and 2 days after the nominations were released, certainly I saw quite a bit on my social media, you know, that, you know, this is the patriarchy. This is exactly how Hollywood has always worked, right? I think it's unfortunate in some respects, but you know, I think Robert Downey Jr. ultimately is going to take home the Academy Award, not Ryan Gosling. So I don't know. It's a kind of a tricky situation. But I and Ryan Gosling, I'm sure, will be there to perform the song. Billie Eilish, of course, will be there, and I think she'll ultimately take the Academy Award home for best song.
Well, let's pause there on best original song this year. We're going to hear part of Wazaza, the song for My People from Killers of the Flower Moon. So the ceremony itself features the performances for song nominees. What are you expecting from this year's stage performances?
I think, you know, again, just that charisma, I'm sure, will exude from the various performers. And again, with, you know, I'm Just Ken, I imagine that, you know, I remember years ago when it was one of the nominated songs was Blame Canada from the South Park film.
Yeah.
Well, Robin Williams performed it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's all that pageantry and you know, all the bells and whistles. So I expect that certainly will likely be a high point of the night. And then, you know, certainly more reflective, more serious songs like What Was I Made For, you know, that will be kind of, you know, more of a contemplative moment. A Song for My People, you know, that also being a little bit more contemplative, right? So the dynamics will certainly be interesting there to watch with the performances, the music performances.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater, as we discuss the Academy Award nominations, taking it all in. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We talk about the Academy Award nominations from a year where a record 3 films directed by women were nominated for Best Picture, Barbie, Anatomy of a Fall, and Past Lives. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater, is our guide. We're going to move on here to Best Supporting Actress and take a look at Jodie Foster for her role as Bonnie Stoll in Diana Nyad's Best Friend and Swim Coach. That's, as we talked about, played by Annette Bening. And so let's hear a scene where Stoll decides to stay with Nyad on her swim from Havana, Cuba to Key West.
I tried doing my own thing, but it just wasn't the same.
You're not a quitter.
Point is, we're getting old together. You know, we're getting old. And if you die, I want to be the last person you see. But don't die. But if you do, I'm going to be right there with you.
What are Jodie Foster's chances of winning for Best Supporting Actress?
Well, I don't think she probably has much of a chance, just because I've Divine Joy Rudolph from The Holdovers, I think, has kind of been favored there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I've also heard that Danielle Brooks might have a shot for The Color Purple as well. And so and of course, again, Jodie Foster has 2 Oscars already. She achieved them both before she was 30 years old, which is kind of incredible. But I think, too, you know, the supporting actor categories, that's oftentimes an area where, you know, say The Holdovers, right, is not going to win Best Picture. So
mm-hmm.
then where else can we award, you know, this film? And so that, you know, is, I think, too obviously a calculation of voters in that sense. And I should note that, you know, Paul Giamatti also has a real shot to win Best Actor for The Holdovers. And this is a film by Alexander Payne, who Alexander Payne is not nominated as a director, but, you know, he's another director that's been turning out really consistently strong films for quite a long time, you know, starting with Election in the late 1990s, you know, more recently movies like Nebraska, Sideways. Mm-hmm. And so I think that Divine Joy Rudolph will be a sort of a way to award not just The Holdovers itself, but also, you know, kind of a conciliatory prize for Alexander Payne as well. So, but I love Jodie Foster's performance in Nyad. I mean, we really have some excellent work all the way through that category. Even America Ferrera, right? No, that was rather controversial that she got nominated for Barbie in that category. A lot of folks have said that, you know, she's really there because of that monologue that she delivered that was very impressive that in Barbie, it kind of that standalone. I mean, that part was a much smaller role than any of the other roles in that category. So, yeah.
So when you look at the puzzle pieces of the Oscars in a way, and where, you know, what films go where. So there are 24 Oscar categories, and I'm just wondering, you know, as we Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, Actors, that gets all the attention. Is there any category you think we should care more about or that seems to get overlooked?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, I always feel like the screenwriting is something that could get more play than it does. Mm. You know, especially this year when, you know, the writer's strike was so hard on the industry and of course the actors too, but you know, the famous screenwriter, then eventually director Billy Wilder always said that writers were the most important people in Hollywood. And I don't, honestly, the writers have never gotten, you know, the respect I think that they ultimately deserve for, ultimately being the storytellers, right? And so I wish, yeah, sometimes I do wish that the screenplay categories would just be elevated just a little bit more than they are. Mm. I also, this year in particular, sound, you know, the best sound is oftentimes it's dominated by, you know, the kind of blockbuster movies. Mission Impossible, I think, you know, was in that category this year. And just, you know, the movies that are, you know, the more sort of not as intellectual, you might say. Uh-huh. But this year it's interesting because I have not seen it yet. The Zone of Interest is a film that is tells the story of the commandant of Auschwitz and his family and how they lived essentially right next to Auschwitz. And the way that the horror of Auschwitz is relayed in this film is largely through its sound. Hmm. And the way some really interesting things, it sounds like, are done through sound. And so, you know, I just think it would be fascinating if that film won Best Sound, because it is so different and so creative as compared to, you know, just your typical explosions and car chases in a movie like Mission Impossible. So
it goes beyond that, right?
Right.
I'm just wondering if you notice more, and I don't even know if it has anything to do with the strikes or work stoppages, but like just the crossover of directors, also getting producer credits, getting screenwriter credits, like just kind of how Hollywood seems to be having a lot, maybe just more crossover into these different areas of you know, the artistry of these movies. And I'm just wondering if you notice anything there.
Well, I just think that, you know, ultimately, I think the lessons from a lot of these movies this year is that, you know, it takes a lot of luck to get a movie made in the first place, mm-hmm. and a lot of happenstance. And so with Oppenheimer, for example, There was an LA Times essay a few months ago about the long path, the book American Prometheus, on which Oppenheimer is based. How first the path to getting that book finished, but then through just a whole series of occurrences, the book came to the attention of the actor James Woods, and James Woods brought the book to the attention of Christopher Nolan.
Who read it three times, I understand. Right. And it's over 700 pages.
And so how movies get made in the first place, it was kind of an incredible story. The documentary category is really interesting in that respect too. And so you have a movie like the Tiger movie. Mm-hmm. You have Mindy Kaling is a producer on that, right? To Kill a Tiger. Mindy Kaling and Dev Patel. So two really kind of heavy hitters in Hollywood really had to, you know, be involved, right? To in order to get a movie like that made. And I think it does come down to money. And ultimately at the end of the day, movie making is a business. And so you need people in power and you need people who have money to get movies made. And that is an unfortunate truth, but that's why certain movies get so much more publicity and become the hot movie, is because they have that machinery behind them.
That machinery behind them. And in our last moments together, movie theaters, are they still alive? And is it the Barbenheimer phenomenon that they have to thank?
Well, they are still alive. I mean, they had a tough go these last few years, of course. But I think, again, the Barbenheimer phenomenon, it just really proved that people do want to see movies in theaters. And I guess I can close out here by, you know, Martin Scorsese, at the end of Killers of the Flower Moon, you know, he essentially says to his audience, like, you know, thank you for coming to see this movie in a theater, right? And, you know, it was kind of self-referential, of course, in a way, but also like that, you know, theaters do really still have a role to play in our culture, and they are perhaps a little more endangered than they used to be. But, you know, industry critics have been saying all the way back to the 1950s that movie theaters were in trouble. Mm-hmm. So, and they're still very much around. So,
Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's been fun.
It has. Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies in English at UW-Whitewater. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.